Thank you, Dave. Hello and welcome. I have three questions that I'd like to ask this august body. The first, how many of you have an MD or medical doctor's degree? Raise your hands. Well, there are a few. Okay. Second, how many of you have an MBA, Master of Business Administration? Look at all the hands. Last question. How many of you have both an MBA and an MD? What happened to you guys and gals? Welcome to the world of Risa Leviso Mori. Risa was admitted to Harvard Medical School after completing her junior year in high school and received her MD degree in 1979. She earned her MBA in healthcare policy at the Wharton School in the University of Pennsylvania, from which she graduated in 1986, so she has both. This combination is rare and reflects her interest in the interface among public policy, clinical medicine, and business. This positioned her to become an effective consultant on public health policies, serving as an advisor to the first Bush administration and also the Clinton administration. Using her business background, she started a plan at the foundation to distribute funds through a portfolio system, engaging other entities with similar interests to evaluate programs more effectively on a national basis. When I learned she was a specialist in geriatrics and obesity, I said to myself, what a perfect person to come and speak at the Forum Club. I also asked her if she'd be my personal physician. She said, no, you're too far gone. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the ninth largest in the world, was founded in 1972. It was named after the son of the founder of the Johnson & Johnson Company. Robert Wood Johnson also served as CEO. It has assets of $8.7 billion, and funds grants of about $400 million per year. It is the largest foundation in the world, focusing on improving health and healthcare in a nonpartisan fashion. Ralph Larson, retired chairman and CEO of Johnson & Johnson and a member of the Foreign Club, also serves on the board of this foundation. He's right down here, Ralph. Risa's parents were both physicians, and her husband, Bob, who was unable to be here today, holds a Ph.D. They have two grown children. You might be interested to learn that she and her daughter climbed Mount Kilimanjaro last year. This is an interesting way to elevate your career. It also clearly illustrates she practices what she preaches about fitness. It is a great personal honor and privilege for me to welcome and introduce Dr. Risa Leviso Mori, President and CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Risa?
Thank you. Thank you, Tom, for that incredibly generous introduction. When I hear an introduction like that, I often wish my kids were here. Might get a little respect at home, but really it is really wonderful to be here. I want to thank Tom and Dave for inviting me to be here. It's nice and warm, and you've got a nice warm welcome, certainly a lot warmer than it is right now here in New Jersey. So I want to talk to you about something that is really, I think, on all of our minds. And then I want to have a really lively discussion, because I notice here that we've got students who are all planning to go into medicine or healthcare, and so I feel like we've got our future ahead of us in a very positive way. But it's important for us to, as a community, think about how we can make health and healthcare better. And the message I have for you really is one that I talked to Ralph Larson about just a few days ago. And by the way, he's the kind of trustee that everyone wants to have on their board, because he gets what private resources can do to change the trajectory of healthcare and to make society better. When I was talking to Ralph about my message, his enthusiasm for it really gave me a greater resolve. So let's talk then about how to improve health and healthcare, and particularly about the cost crisis that all of us have the power to change in our hands. Now, health and healthcare is local. There's no question about it. When you think about the snapshot of health and your own healthcare, it's up. Are you having trouble hearing me? Maybe we can turn the volume up just a little bit. Is that better? Not much? Maybe a little more volume. So I want to just mention, is that a little bit better? Okay. I want to talk about the snapshot of health and healthcare that we get when we go to the doctor and it's about getting good health, or when there's a nurse by your bedside who's delivering the care that you need right then at that moment. That's what most of us really, really care about. But there's another facet of the healthcare picture that also has us in it. But when you step back, there's other things in the frame as well. There are factors and facets that actually have a big part of how well we're able to live and how well huge chunks of the population are able to live. You have here in Naples and in Collier County what every American community wants and needs. You're the healthiest county in Florida. Now, every year, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation analyzes a lot of data about populations in every single county around the country. That's about 3,143 counties. 67 of them are right here in Florida. And we rank them according to a whole range of factors that you can see if you go to countyhealthrankings.org. And what will jump out at you when you look at that is that where you live really does matter for your health. Collier County is the healthiest county, but the next county over, Lee County, is number 23. County next over on the other side, Hendry County, is 39. And Glades County is 58. So how can just a few miles difference make such a difference in how healthy a county is? Well, we know that how healthy you are depends on individual behaviors, of course, but it also depends on education and income and your job and your social networks. There's a lot that you can do to vary health county to county. The truth is, our health is dependent on where we live, work, and play as it is on our DNA, and certainly as much as it is on what we do within the healthcare system. We refer to these as social determinants of health, and most people aren't really even aware of them, but they're real. And if your physicians over the years, if you think back to whether your physicians have asked you questions about where you lived or where you worked and how you got your food and how much schooling you had, and whether or not you had a network of friends and family and social supports to be there when you needed it. Those are the kind of screening questions that I hope your doctors have been asking you over the years about the social determinants of health. And if they haven't, I hope you'll encourage them to do it in the future. One of the reasons that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation developed the county health rankings was to help medical people, community leaders, and concerned citizens like all of you understand that truly where we live, learn, work, and play does have a lot to do with how we live, how healthy we are, and frankly, how long we live. And I want you to keep this in mind because it has everything to do with how we can bring down the costs of health care as well. So let me tell you a story that reveals a little bit of my thinking on the health care cost problem and what people like us can do about it. I have a sister who's younger than me. We call her Rel. And when she was a toddler, she ran right into a door jamb and was knocked unconscious. She was laying on the floor. It was scary. But as Tom mentioned, my parents were both physicians. And so as they were resuscitating her, they were calling to me to call the fire department, to call the police, to call an ambulance. Because back then, you didn't have an emergency medical system. Every call was a different call, and it seemed like it took forever. The first responders back then were actually pretty slow responders, and it was a big reason that thousands of people died because of trauma and accidents. Now, fortunately, my little sister was one of the lucky ones, but accidents and trauma were the leading cause of death for everyone from birth to their late 30s. What was at the root cause of the problem? Well, there were no two-way radios. Emergency responders had to call each person separately. It was a separate call each time, and they couldn't call back to their headquarters. They couldn't be in contact with the hospital. And so people with injuries arrived in emergency rooms without the doctors or nurses knowing that they were coming, much less what they might expect. Now, it came down to turf battles between first responders and their jurisdictions and who was going to pay for these integrated communication systems. That was back when our foundation was just getting started. We were in an office that was really a house in a residential community in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I bet you Ralph Larson remembers that little house on Livingston Street in New Brunswick. And the tiny staff of the foundation at that time sat around and said, what can we do to help solve this problem? Their plan was to go to local jurisdictions and to say, we will pay for the communication systems so long as you settle your differences locally and agree to do an evaluation that will allow us to see whether this works. They did, and we did. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation became the catalyst for pulling people together in a way that allowed them to solve problems together. The 911 system was what resulted, and 4 years and $65 million later, there was a paramedic unit within 10 minutes of half of the U.S. population. Today, it's routine in every community, and we just take it for granted. But now, the story doesn't stop there. When Katrina hit, one of the worst storms that we've experienced in this nation, the only functioning communication system between New Orleans and the Mississippi coast was the Arcadian Ambulance Service. We had, with one of our very first grants, started the connection between those two-way dispatchers and the local hospitals in Arcadia. At the peak of the Katrina disaster, the only communication system that was operating was Arcadians' calm dispatchers who were giving reassurance to people at that terrible time. Now, you can talk about return on investments, but to me, that's a real return on investment. And in our business of philanthropy, it just doesn't get any better than that. We are in our 40th year as a foundation, and 911 was one of our first big successes. What we learned during that was what can be accomplished when you get all sorts of folks to work together, even those that are more used to fighting than working together. We often refer to them as strange bedfellows at the foundation, and we believe that when you can get business leaders and community leaders working together, they can do what none of us individually can do on our own. So my view then about a lot of what is a problem in our healthcare costs today goes back to the way we thought about the emergency services back then. There are lots of fights over turf and money. Competition trumps cooperation. The short term frustrates the long term. And figuratively, the patient ends up sort of sprawled on the pavement, waiting for the system to fix itself. As a nation, we can't seem to come up with a national solution to fix what ails our healthcare system, which, broken or not, like it or not, really is too big to fail. And meanwhile, the cost curve is going up, and there doesn't seem to be a national strategy to bring it down. Now, I don't want to bore you with a lot of statistics, but I do want to give you a sense of what the picture looks like if you paint it by the numbers. We spend about $2.7 trillion on healthcare in this country, more than any other country on earth, and it's expected to go up about 6% a year for the foreseeable future. If our healthcare system were a national economy, it would be the fifth largest economy in the world. That would be right behind Germany and just ahead of France. And here's a number that, for me, is really hard to swallow. About a third of what we spend is unwarranted and wasteful. That's about $1 trillion, maybe even a little bit more. They're unnecessary treatments, redundant tests, errors. Indirectly or directly, that costs healthcare, costs employers about 30%. Now, let me give you a real-life example. There's a patient that I know very well, pretty savvy about healthcare costs and really cost-conscious, who went in for an elective procedure. Week before, she'd gotten an EKG to make sure that everything was okay. But when she got in to actually get the procedure, they'd come in to do another EKG. So she said, why? How come? Well, as it turns out, they couldn't find it on the chart. So the doctor ordered another one. They repeated the same test, the same way, the same price. And I have to tell you, it was really unnecessary. Every time we go to the hospital, to doctor's offices, to clinics, to urgent centers, this kind of redundancy is happening all around us. I guarantee it. And what about the costs? How many of you know what your last set of blood work costs? Raise your hands. What about, how much does an MRI cost in this town? Anyone know? I'm surprised to see as many hands up as I did. Most people have no idea what their cost is. The bills go to the insurance companies or to Medicare, and we are totally disconnected from it, except for a copay, which admittedly is going up. It's the only part of our national economy that we let run this way, and I just don't think it makes sense. One more thing that may be a little controversial. I was talking with Lisa about this over lunch. The fee-for-service system that Marcus Welby sort of grew up with and I grew up with is fast becoming an albatross around our neck. Nothing much has changed since the 1900s in a lot of the way we pay for medical care. There's a payment that goes for a service, and the incentive is to do more, not necessarily to do what's better. We need more incentives to do what's better rather than to just do more. It's almost like we would consider buying a car based on the weight rather than how well it performs. And if we don't change our ways, sooner or later, we're going to have a healthcare system that costs more than we as individuals, than our government, and than our businesses can afford to pay. It's a statistical fact that if you look at the trend, and we don't do anything more to increase, to change that increasing trajectory of costs, we're going to spend about 25% of our GDP on healthcare by the time my little 3-year-old granddaughter gets out of high school. The average American family understands this. They really have seen their copays go up. They've seen that they're paying more out of pocket. And in the last decade, they've seen half of their income gains go to healthcare costs. Frankly, no family, no community, no business, none of us can sustain this kind of cost. There's not a magic fix, but there is a way out of it. And to me, the way out of it is what people like you in this room can do to move us forward. Because you see, there's a quiet revolution going on about healthcare where it really counts locally in communities like these. You don't hear much about it on the national news, but there is going to be a PBS special about it this week. But when I travel, I see that increasingly businesses and healthcare providers and consumers and patients and community leaders are coming together to learn what they can do together to change healthcare. They're finding common ground. They're finding ways to put aside past differences. They're looking for new partnerships and cooperating even while they compete to agree on what to fix and how to fix it. But most of all, what they're doing is they're co-creating the tough work of finding how to better our healthcare system, how to deliver higher quality at a lower cost that's more efficient and that actually meets the needs of people like you in their communities. You see it in bits and pieces in virtually every community. I was scrolling through the websites that are local here in Naples, and I saw the Healthcare Resource Guide. It's put out by the Naples News. I like that. It gives great information. I also found that on Tuesday nights, one of your local banks has what they call a bank call, where people can come in and get information about healthcare. I like that too. Last week, I was in Nashville, and they have a healthcare council, which is a group of 200 healthcare leaders that gets together like this at lunch once a week to talk about how they can manage the healthcare system and the changes that are coming before it manages them. I wish every community would model the kinds of things that Nashville is doing. So in my travels, I see health systems and hospitals that are making changes to improve their care and reduce costs. And they're learning that it doesn't take a wrecking ball to do this. Out in Seattle, my hometown, there's a hospital called Virginia Mason. And they have been working with employers because, frankly, the employers were dissatisfied that their outpatients were taking so long to get the care that they need, and they were losing money in their business. So looking for answers, Virginia Mason took 10 steps that it usually takes a person to get outpatient care and said, which of these don't we need to do? And they were able to eliminate 7 of them. As a result, people are getting their treatments faster. That means they're getting better faster. The hospital is using fewer resources. That means less overhead costs, which means they're able to bring their costs down. Patients are getting back to work faster, and they are really happy. But you know what? The employers are ecstatic because they've been able to see, on average, a 56% decrease in the amount of days people take off from work to get outpatient care. That's what the future of less costly, higher quality care looks like. And it doesn't take rocket science to get there. But what it does take is a willing to change how we think about healthcare and put a focus on the evidence and on putting patients first. So to me, we're on the verge of a paradigm shift that is unlike any shift in healthcare that I've seen in my professional career. And I think it's happening because everyone, providers, patients, consumers, businesses, are right on the edge of seeing that we've got to do something different as leaders. Now, sure, there are the provisions of the Affordable Care Act that are coming online, and we all know that the Supreme Court is going to rule later on whether a lot of those provisions stay in effect. Experts say that a lot of the law is going to remain intact. But you know what? I don't think that it is going to depend so much on what the court says, because all around the country, local players are starting to bring scenarios into play that change the business dynamic in healthcare. It's not about politics when it's local. It's about being good business people. For example, many providers are acknowledging that people are fed up with the fact that they can't find out what the cost of health care really is. Transparency is the buzzword that you hear in my world, but what it really means is no more secrets about what it actually costs to get the services that I'm going to pay for in a minute. It means, and we see information technology, social networks, and the like, making it possible for people to see the cost of healthcare right out in the open. It is hard to do. It's not going to be easy. Just last week, there was a study coming out of Denver where someone asked the 19 hospitals in Denver what it cost to get a knee replacement if you were a Medicare beneficiary. 12 of the hospitals didn't answer the call. The others gave a range of between $33,000 and $101,000, $33,000 to $101,000, based on a bunch of factors that was hard for the hospitals to explain, and it's very difficult for physicians to understand, and frankly, the patients don't even know about. But fortunately, there are websites that you can go to now where you can actually get information about cost and quality of local providers and hospitals. Remember the EKG that I mentioned a little while ago? Well, if you go on Healthcare Blue Book, or if you look it up and New Healthcare Choice, you'll find that depending on the location and the provider, it can cost anywhere from $470 to $2,850 for the same EKG. It's a difference of about $2,400. You multiply that times two, you know, you do the math, it starts to add up. Another factor. Physician groups are starting to come together and say that they've got to do something about it as well. There's a partnership that is evolving among medical specialties called Choosing Wisely. Young people going into medicine, listen to this. It's a group of internists, family doctors, cardiologists, oncologists, thoracic surgeons. One of you is planning to be a thoracic surgeon, I thought I heard. And what they're saying is that patients and doctors have to talk together honestly about overuse and misuse of medical procedures that have little benefit to do good and possibly could do harm. It's an acknowledgement by my profession that patients and physicians have to work together, that we're partners on the same path, and that the partnership depends on a free flow of information about both quality and costs. Right here in Naples, you can go online and you can find out how your hospitals are doing. NCH, Southwest, Lee. All you need to do is go to hospitalquality.com or Hospital Compare, and you can see that they actually are doing pretty well. Part of the reason is that they're good hospitals, but the other reason is that Collier County is such a healthy place. So as a private foundation, we think that it's important for us to provide the infrastructure and do some of the work that allows this data to be available to you. The government puts it out there without any comment, but frankly, it's up to you to use it as a consumer so that you can make better choices about your own health care. Now, at our foundation, we've been waiting for this moment where people are ready for a change in healthcare for a long time, because we've been working on quality and reducing disparities and helping people get insured and trying to improve the public health system and prevention. But the sum total of all that we've done has really just prepared us for the kinds of things that we have to do together at this point. Last month, our board of trustees authorized us to go out and have conversations with people like you, along with the private sector and the healthcare leaders. Our assignment, they said, was to provide the motivation and means for a public interest, private and business-based resolve to change healthcare. It's public interest because individuals, families, communities, the business community, institutions, every organization in the American body politic has an interest in the outcome of these kinds of discussions. It's private sector and business based because we're convinced that the private sector holds the best chance for making the best answers. I have to tell you that the MBA in me is convinced that the marketplace, motivated and mobilized is the best and surest way to make sure that this paradigm shift that we're going through serves us rather than hurts us. Are there going to be obstacles and difficulties? Absolutely. Will we succeed? With your help, I believe we will. We can turn the difficult into the doable and help catalyze a change in American medicine. I think there are two things that we have to do. First, we have to co-create the kinds of consensus about for the practical solutions that will endure. And two, we have to coordinate action towards changes that will actually reduce spending and increase the value of healthcare. But make no mistake, this is big. It's important to us. It's a 911 moment. We're not talking about a think tank or a campaign or a glitzy TV ad series. We're talking about helping savvy leaders like you come together and co-create a path forward to protect and improve our health. It's steps that the private sector can take right now. For example, hospitals all around the country can do a Virginia Mason and actually take control of the costs within their hospitals and take out unnecessary steps. It's like reconciling what healthcare actually costs with what we actually pay for. And it's like eliminating things like that extra EKG that I told you about so that we don't have to eliminate services that people actually need. It's time, I think, for us also to take a hard look at the reimbursement system for physicians. Just last week, UnitedHealth announced that they were going to change how they reimburse physicians and hospitals. They're going to move away from a strictly fee-for-service system to one that compensates physicians and hospitals in part for the quality of care that they deliver. Payers are realizing that we can't keep paying for unnecessary readmissions just because the hospital didn't get the mark right the first time. I don't know if you know this, but 1 in 5 hospitalizations results in the patient returning to the hospital within 30 days, and that costs taxpayers, us, $12 billion a year. It's a cost that we can't afford, and it's not like we don't know how to fix it. We do. We actually know that having nurses coordinate the care goes a long way towards reversing and reducing those readmissions. The problem is that Medicare will pay for the readmission, but it won't pay for the nurse to coordinate the care. Yeah, it's the kind of crazy catch-22 that we just can't afford to have anymore in healthcare. Now, one more big area I want to mention, and that's prevention. It's often neglected and overlooked because we spend about 95% of our healthcare dollar on getting people care when they're sick, and only 5% on keeping them from being sick in the first place. Do you know that if we were able to collectively reduce our body weight by about 5% as a population, we would save $30 billion over the next year? It doesn't make sense to me that people are not paying attention to basic community-based prevention measures. It's not good policy, but the good news to me is that increasingly the business case for prevention is being made and people are starting to listen. For example, research that we funded last year showed that if we spend as a country $10 per person on community-based preventive measures that we know work, we can get a return on investment of about 5 to 1. So communities all around the country are starting to connect the dots between their built environment, how many sidewalks they have, for example, bike paths and the like, and what actually they can see in their population. We know that if you have sidewalks, people are 28% more likely to walk than if you don't. So that's why Nashville is spending $7 million on a sidewalk project, even as they're a financially stressed city. It's why countries outside of the U.S. and why many communities here are recognizing that they need to put more parks, like you have here in Collier County, in their environments. Because if you live within a mile of a park, you're 65% more likely to be physically active than if you live more than a mile away. So you're probably sitting there wondering, what does this have to do with people like us? Well, the bottom line is, no matter what your station in life is, when it comes to your own personal health, you're not interested in the wonky stuff or the jargon. You want to have doctors and nurses who are going to deliver the care that you need. You want hospitals who are going to be trustworthy and compassionate and are going to coordinate your care and give you just the care that you need and not any more. And you want to know that they're going to honor you as partners in your own care. You need a system that provides you with the information, whether it's online or not, that will allow you to make good decisions about what ails you, and at the same time give you information about the realities of the costs so you can make good decisions. All across America, communities like the ones that I mentioned, Virginia Mason, Nashville, Grand Junction, Colorado, are coming together to have these kinds of discussions. You may say, well, why did it take us so long to get to this moment? Well, maybe Churchill is right about us. Americans will do the right thing after we've exhausted all other possibilities. But to that, I say Americans do the right thing when we do it together. And I believe that we have an opportunity now to bring business leaders, healthcare leaders, wise people like you together to come up with a method individual communities can use to solve their own healthcare problems. The doctor who was the first president of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's name was David Rogers. He was a really incredible leader, scientist, cared deeply about improving health and healthcare, particularly for the most vulnerable. And he taught us a lot about what it takes to do large-scale philanthropy. He said, to effect workable social change, philanthropy has to be realistically timed to coincide with the readiness of society to take action. Well, I believe that society is ready. As a foundation, we're ready. And so I hope that you are ready, because it's communities like yours that have the answers to solve our healthcare dilemma. Thank you very much. I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you very much. We do have some gifts for you to take home with you. We have the book about Marco Island and a book about Naples, Florida, for you to remember this occasion. And we also would mention that we have over 400 members. We have over 370 on the waiting list. But should you choose to become a member, you immediately jump the waiting list.
All right.
We have you as a member. And now I'll turn it over to Tom Wheeler.
Thank you very much.
Risa, we have a lot of good questions. Here's
okay.
One from the students. How can we best spread our medical ideologies to third world countries like Haiti and Ghana? Many people have died in these countries because they do not have an adequate health care system to respond to tragedies such as the earthquake that occurred in Haiti and a couple of years ago.
It's a great question. I think that you should know about a lot of the programs that exist in medical schools now, particularly for people that are young and interested in learning about international medicine, where you can actually do a month or two in a different country and learn how to not only spread what you know technically, but do what is so important in healthcare, which is building relationships between your hospital and other hospitals there. So that's one thing that we can do. There are a number of groups like Doctors Without Borders that allow practicing physicians to actually go and work in a disaster, or to do healthcare procedures that ordinarily wouldn't be available. So that's a second way. And then I think the third way is by the kind of philanthropic efforts that you see so wonderfully during times of need like Haiti, where organizations like the Salvation Army, like the Red Cross, actually allow people to, like me, to go boots on the ground and make a contribution. So there are a lot of ways in the immediate that we can do that. But I think on a larger scale, it's going to be important for us to exchange ideas, scientists, with countries around the world so that we continue to learn from them as we are helping them to learn from us.
There are a number of questions about cost, and there are a number of questions about Obamacare. Maybe they're linked, but let's try the cost issue. Some people think it's tort reform is necessary, defensive medicine associated with delivering end of care. What, in your view, is the driving force of the increased cost of Medicare?
Well, certainly all of those things are factors, but the thing I try to emphasize is it's no one aspect. Yes, tort reform and defensive medicine costs us money. About $60 billion is related to that. That's real money, but it's not the whole picture, obviously. End-of-life care, we hear a lot about end-of-life care, but the examples that I gave you were not end-of-life care at all. Doing unnecessary EKGs on people who are middle-aged is not end-of-life care. What is important, I think, in the message that I have is that the communities that are starting to lower the cost of care and improve the quality in their communities, they are developing partnerships, like the one I described at Virginia Mason, where they say, what are the five or six things that we can do together that will allow us to bring down costs? One area at a time. You can't boil the ocean on this, but you can approach it in a prioritized way, one aspect at a time.
Okay, here we go. What are your thoughts on Obamacare? Also, are there any parts of it that you think should be retained, or should we just discard it and start all over?
No. Well, first of all, our foundation has been working to try to ensure that people had access to health care since the very early days. Our founder, Robert Wood Johnson, is quoted as saying he wanted to do everything he could to make sure that people had good health and access to good health care. So we've long been committed to trying to make sure that people had health insurance. And this law will increase the number of people that have health insurance. There are problems with it. No doubt. I focused a lot on some of the things that I think are problems. The fact that there's not enough to bring down the cost of care. Whether or not it's going to stand, I can't prophesize on that. But I do think that whatever happens, it's not going to be the end game. The end game is going to come when we take what is good from there and we add to it the kinds of things that can happen in communities like this.
Here's one. What have you found to be the most successful program for combating obesity?
Climbing Kilimanjaro!
This is not a personal question.
Well, like many of you, or like many Americans, I think about my weight and struggle with it every day. But I think that it's a combination of what we do individually and how easy as a society we make it possible for people to make the right choice when they're making choices. And if you think about how our society has changed over the last 40 years when obesity has continually gone up, it's becoming increasingly easy to make the unhealthy choice. People used to walk more. When I was a kid, I walked to school. It was about a mile. Less than 10% of kids now walk to school, even if they live within a mile. If you go to a restaurant, chances are you don't know how many calories you're eating. And most Americans eat out at least once a week, whereas in the past, that wasn't the case. Many families eat out three or four times a week. And when you eat out, you tend to take in anywhere from 200 to 500 more calories than when you eat at home. So having the calories in front of you when you're making those choices is one way. I think that having policies in place that help people be healthy at work and at school. We have coffee breaks at work. Some businesses still have cigarette breaks. Not many, but some still do. We need to have activity breaks. We get about 2 hours less physical activity in our work day now than we did 20 years ago. So again, there are a lot of things that we can do to make the environment easier for people to make healthy choices so that they can do the individually responsible thing, which is to make those healthy choices.
Two questions left. What is your, it's pretty popular in Naples. What is your opinion of the trend towards concierge medicine? I think it's a pretty popular environment.
Yeah. For those who don't know, concierge medicine is a way of engaging your physician where you pay a retainer, essentially, and then depending on the partnership you have and the terms of the contract, you either pay a fee for each time you see the physician or not. Sometimes it's totally prepaid. And to me, it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about some of the changes we need to make in the fee-for-service system. Doctors and patients in a concierge system have said, we think that the payment needs to be different in order for me, the physician, to have the incentive and the resources to do what you want me to do, which is to spend the amount of care and time coordinating and treating you. So I think that there's some lessons that we can take in how concierge medicine is designed and contracted to learn about to implement in other payment systems. It's really nice to be able to afford concierge medicine. I personally think that we can take some of those lessons and extend them to a lot more people who are perhaps less well off.
The last one. The great tennis athlete, Martina Navratilova, tried to climb Kilimanjaro,
yeah.
Kilimanjaro, and was unable to do it. Was that climb your most difficult physical challenge and achievement? And I guess I would ask, does that mean you're in better shape than Navratilova?
It was my most difficult physical and mental challenge. It doesn't mean I'm in better shape than she was. I probably went more slowly. And also, I'm a little older. So one of the things that happens as you get older is your brain shrinks just a little bit, and so there's more space in the head for it to swell as you're going up Kilimanjaro. But it was a tremendous trip and a wonderful thing to be able to do with my daughter.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Risa. You're so nice to come and see us, and your remarks are very, very well taken. I think you had a great audience. It was very interesting. So
hope
you come back.
I will.
Become a member.
Yes, sir.
We are adjourned. Please remember to turn in your name badges at the door. We'll see you a week from today.